The sermon today is going to be part three of a series that I've been doing on Joseph. So we're going to look at, this will be part three, there will be one more to come. And to begin the sermon today, we're going to begin in Romans 8, verse 28. Romans 8, verse 28. Now, why begin in Romans 8, verse 28 when it comes to Joseph? Well, the reason is because in many ways, the experiences that Joseph went through tie in with this particular verse. This is a verse that is not only well illustrated by Joseph's life, but it's something that is crucial to our lives, and to understand how it works, it's important for us to realize God is working with us. And this verse is very applicable to all of us as well. Verse 28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." And the saga of Joseph and his brothers is an exceptionally clear example of this principle. And we're going to discuss that here as we begin this sermon. If God is involved in our lives, we can be assured that there's more to what is going on than meets the eye. And we have to realize that this verse applies to all of us, that the fact is all things work together for good to all of us. And there are reasons for that. We can be assured that that's the way it is because of the way God is. That's what he is. And the second reason is he's working not only to create us in his image, but he's also using us for some purpose that is good for others as well. That he's working in our lives so that ultimately we will impact other people as Joseph did. It may not necessarily be right here, right now, but God is working in our lives to prepare us to impact other people. Now, some of us may impact people right now, but we can be assured if we don't impact the world right now, we are definitely going to impact the world to come. So God is working in our lives, and he's preparing us for something that lies off in the future. And sometimes that preparation, we can't see it. We don't know what's going on. We don't see it, but yet it is taking place. And it is comforting to know that in each of our lives, God is working in that way. He is working out a purpose in our lives, and it may have an impact in the here and now, but most assuredly, it is going to have an impact in the future. Now, when the verse says, when all things, you know, as you think, all things work together for good, well, does that include manufactured things? You know, does that mean your automobile or a gun or your cell phone? That doesn't really mean manufactured things. It's looking to things that involve experiences. All of the experiences that we go through lend themselves to our being prepared for what God is working out in our lives, to prepare us for the world to come. And these experiences primarily revolve around our relationship with God and how he is working in our lives, and how we take what we learn from God and we experience with God, and how we apply it in our relationships with others. Another thing is that he's not saying that the evil that we go through is good. So when we live in this life, there are times we go through evil. So is that what God intended for us? Why is it that we go through evil? Sometimes maybe we've caused it, but many times it comes about as a result of people sinning around us. We've not necessarily done anything wrong, but what other people do does impact us. And, you know, God is able to accomplish his purpose in us. You may not have thought of this, but he's able to accomplish his purpose in us without sin or evil in our lives. That's not necessary. It ought to be clear to us from the theme of the Bible itself that God does not intend that we suffer as a result of evil. That's not what God intended. It's God's desire to bless. It is God's desire to give us every good thing. And he knows that evil brings curses, and evil brings difficulty in our lives. All you have to do is stop and think about the millennial kingdom. Think about that. We live in a world with Satan here, don't we? But the people in the millennial kingdom, the first and foremost thing that's going to take place after Christ returns is that Satan will be moved out of the way. And all of the sin and the evil that has characterized this world will be at a minimum in that age. And what the prophets tell us and what the scriptures tell us about that age is this, that people can learn and grow and fulfill God's purpose in their lives without war. They can have their purpose fulfilled and God's purpose fulfilled in their lives as the deserts bloom, as there are clear rivers and streams, there's pure air, they're living in harmony with their neighbors. All of these good things, and God can still accomplish His purpose. The millennial kingdom illustrates that God's purpose can be worked out without the kind of evil we have in this world. Now, we're used to that, and that's what we consider as we think about growing and maturing in the faith, is dealing with the different challenges that come our way, the trials and difficulties. But as I said, the millennial kingdom illustrates that God's purpose can be worked out without the kind of evil we currently have. So we can see that God's original intention was not to have to go through all the trauma of sin and evil. Sin and the subsequent suffering is a fact of life. And why is that? Because that's the path that man has chosen. Man has chosen the path of sin. He's chosen to live apart from God. And the outcome of sin is inevitable. It is inevitable. Sin is the breaking of God's law, and the breaking of God's law brings consequences. And we know that if we keep the law, if we live by the law, whether they're physical or they're spiritual, for instance, if we're on, you know, if we're up high and we step off the roof or whatever it may be, we're going to go down. And that's the law of physics. You're going to fall and possibly be injured. But that law is always in operation, and the spiritual laws are always in operation as well. And so there's a consequence to falling off the roof or stepping off the roof, and there's a consequence to sin. And so what has God promised us? Well, God has promised to cooperate with us during these trials. So we face a world where sin is commonplace, and we sin as well. But God said, I will cooperate with you in the midst of dealing with life in this present world. He's promised to bring trials to a successful conclusion so that they will work for our good. And if you look at the story of Joseph, you see that is one of the great lessons of that experience, that God was involved because Joseph was a person that he had called out and was working with. As let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Now you may be saying, well, we're not dealing with scriptures that deal with Joseph. We will in a bit, but we'll look at some other scriptures here. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, it says, no temptation or test has overtaken you except such as is common to man. So the tests and the trials that we go through are common to man. They're just part of life. And we may experience some tests that other people haven't, but if you go back in time, somebody along the way has probably experienced a similar test. It says, but God is faithful. So as we go through these tests, we know God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted or tested beyond what you are able. God is able to see your situation, and God allows these tests to come our way. And God is faithful. He's involved in our lives. But with the temptation, we'll also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So God, as He allows us to be tested, allows tests to come our way, or tests come our way, then God is there. God is faithful. God will see us through. And God will, if there's a need to escape, He will give us that way of escape. So God is not promising that a trial will not be painful. We've all experienced painful trials. He doesn't say that they won't create some anxiety, which they do. He's not saying that it is good that we go through this, but He is saying that if we do get involved in something like this, a test, a trial, He says that He is there because He is faithful because that is the way he is, and because he has a great purpose in mind for us. And because of these things, somehow or other, he's going to turn lemons into lemonade. So as you think, boy, I've got nothing but lemons and they're awfully sour, he says somehow, some way, these lemons will be turned into lemonade. It's incredible the way that he is able to do this. It is incredible the way that he's able to do this. Because as you look at the life of Joseph and you think about him as he is a young man and things begin to unfold in your life, you could never, ever predict, oh, this guy is going to be second in command in Egypt. It's obvious that this is going to happen. You couldn't foresee that. As you think about Romans 8, verse 28, there are some qualifiers that are attached to this particular verse. It says, all things work together for good to those that love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And what this tells us is this doesn't apply to everybody. It doesn't apply to everybody. Love is used here in the sense of meaning devoted to. It means loyal or faithful, set apart for a higher end. And if we feed that right into that verse, it says that all things work together for good to those that are loyal, to those who are given over to, set apart for a higher end, that are devoted to God. So not everybody's in that condition. Not everybody's in that condition. In actual practice, those who love God are people who will live their lives in a spirit of obedience. They've come to love God, and as we know, if we love God, we will keep his commandments. It doesn't mean that those people are perfect. It doesn't mean that they're devoted, strive. It does mean that they're devoted and striving to live God's way. And certainly they're going to sin from time to time. We sin from time to time. So even though we're not perfect, we are pursuing God. And God does not have to conform to us, but we certainly have to conform to him. And if we are devoted to him, we will do it because we love him. And so our lives then will be given over to him. And note this, it doesn't say that things shall work out for our good. It's not something that's happening in the future. The verbs in that particular sentence are all in the present. They're all in the present tense. And this means that the things that are going on right here and right now in our lives are working for our good. It's not something off in the future that's delayed. They're working right now in our behalf. And notice also that it doesn't say that sin works in our behalf. It doesn't say that. And why is that? Because the person who loves God is not now sinning as a way of life, as something that's habitual. As you look at another quote from Paul in the book of Romans in chapter 6, verse 1, it says, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? And Paul says that that conception is ridiculous. Don't even think of that. Why? Because sin kills. Sin destroys. Sin brings curses. And we may be unwittingly affected by other people's sins, and God will extricate us from the situation. But we will not willfully tempt God and expect him to pull us out of the fire. So we're not going to willfully seek to defy God and expect him to pull us out of the situation. So those who love God are devoted to him. And because they are devoted to him, things will work out for them. And he says that that's going to happen because God will see to that. Just as we're seeking God, God is seeking a relationship with us. Now the word that used there is called reinforces the word love. It does not mean in this verse merely being invited, but rather elected, chosen, an integral part of. That is, we've been called and chosen. We're an integral part of the purpose that God is working out. And God has chosen us out of this world to begin to work in our lives. And therefore, we can be reassured as we go through life that all things work together for good because God has called us. In verse 28, the word "the" is also there. It says, "the called." And so it's a definite group. And it points to a specific person or group of people, those who are the called. So this promise that he gives here applies to a specific group of people. In fact, when we understand it, this is the very reason why all things work together for good. It actually precedes our love, our devotion, because did all things work out for us before God called us? Maybe not. But God intervened in our life, and he began to work with us, and we responded to him. We did not initiate the relationship. He initiated it, and he called us out of this world. You know, for me, growing up apart from the church, I had no clue that this whole process was afoot. I was going through life, minding my own business, doing what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, and had some inkling of God, but I had no idea that God had a greater purpose for me. But you think about, you're going along minding your own business, and however many people were in the world at that time, God selected you and me out of those billions that exist on the earth. And he said, I have a purpose for you. I am giving you the calling. And we became the called. And as a result of that, we could begin to learn what love is and to love God and to love our fellow man. And God shows his love toward us. So thinking of the story of Joseph, there were dark times in his life where it was seen things couldn't get any worse. And as Joseph's probably thinking, this is about as bad as it's going to be, something worse would happen. And it happened several times along the way. And we know the story because we have kind of a bird's eye view of it. But Joseph at that time did not have that view. We know things worked out for him. And God recorded this in the scriptures to help us to know that as we're going through various circumstances in our life that are challenging, God is there and God has a purpose that he's working out. So why did things work out? Because God was involved in Joseph's life, just as he's involved in our lives. And we see that this young man, despite his age, was already well on his way to really loving God. He already loved God by the time he was 17 years old and found himself in the pit. And things worked out the way they did because God was calling him. And God had elected him to be the one through whom a great prophecy and promise was going to be fulfilled. And Paul applies Joseph's experience to you and me. Let's take this one step further. When we get into bad situations, it doesn't mean that God instigated it. It doesn't mean that God instigated it. The story of Joseph illustrates this clearly. God works with what we give him. That's what he did with Joseph. It doesn't mean that this is 100% the way it is. Sometimes God does instigate things. God does initiate things because of his purpose. However, we know that he never takes away our free moral agency. And so sometimes we get ourselves into things or we fall victim to other people's instigating, but God, because he will not take away free moral agency, begins to use that towards his end and our end as well. So God has a purpose for you and me, and God is involved. And we can be reassured that as we go through the experiences that we have in life. So we must avoid ever getting it into our minds that God just does things, instigates these kinds of situations just to put us in a bad spot, or he's somehow playing with us. Because if that were the case, then God would be responsible. But God doesn't just instigate everything, and that way he can judge us. He has a measure by which he can judge us. So the story of Joseph clearly illustrates then that he works with what we give him as a result of our choices. So he works with it. Whatever choices we make, he's able to work with it. The lessons of Joseph also teach us something else. We don't live in a vacuum. You know, people say that there are victimless crimes. There are no victimless crimes. There are no victimless crimes. People can do things, people believe that somehow they can do things in which nobody else gets hurt. But every time you take an action, you're like throwing a rock into a pond. And every time you throw that rock in, there's always going to be a ripple effect. And it's going to have an impact on somebody somewhere. And we have to keep that in mind. It sets up, this idea of victimless crime sets up the sinner as operating in a vacuum. That somehow or other, they can do something that is not going to affect anybody. And that's, nothing could be further from the truth. Basically, the impact is based upon how close you are to where that rock or that pebble went into the pond. You're going to get a bigger ripple effect if you're closer, and you're going to get less if you're further away. So let's go to Genesis 50, verse 20. And this is a crucial verse because it explains what took place in Joseph's life. Genesis chapter 50, and let's look at verse 20. Speaking to his family, he says, "But as for you, you meant evil against me. You intended evil against me." That's what your intention was. But you see, that was your intention, and God worked with your intention. And he says, "But God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive." So his brothers had a negative intention toward him, which we'll look at here in a moment, and God was involved in this to work out a much greater purpose to ensure that many would be saved alive. So you couldn't see that at the time Joseph was going through what he went through. So this is a summary and helps to tie in with Romans 8, verse 28. Joseph didn't know right away what was going on, but by this time he did. There's another clear parallel to Jesus Christ as well. And you can see Joseph was a type of Jesus Christ. As you think about Christ, he came into the world. He came in as a fleshly human being living in Judea. He came to the people of his own tribe. But what did they do? They killed him. They killed him. Their intention was to murder him, just as Joseph's brothers had intended to kill him. They killed Christ. But what was the outcome? Well, he died, yes, but the outcome was a means of salvation for all mankind. And so there's a very clear correlation between Joseph and Jesus Christ. Now let's pick up the story of Joseph in chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. And let's begin in verse 12. Genesis chapter 37, verse 12. "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' So he said to him, 'Here I am.' Then he said to him, 'Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me.' So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem." So it's about a 60-mile journey from Hebron down to Shechem. So it was quite a ways to get to where the brothers were watching over the flocks. So now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard they say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Shechem was a certain distance away, but Dothan is even further away. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. "Well, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him." So here's this family. And you have 12 brothers at this point, and or 13 brothers, and the other brothers are out, and here comes Joseph, and these brothers hated him. They hated him with a passion and desired to kill him. And you think, well, they're family. How could anyone do such a thing? But some of the most greatest emotion and challenge comes in families. Husbands kill wives and vice versa. And murder is sadly all too common in families. And that blood relation is causes a closeness, but it also causes some very heated and challenging disputes. So we see here that they saw him afar off, and they're going to kill him. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. So they took offense at Joseph's dream that he revealed to them. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. So they plot to kill him. But the oldest brother says, heard that, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So as you see here, the brothers intend to kill him. Reuben intervenes to try to save him. And so the story begins to unfold. But here we see very clearly a very sad thing in the family of Jacob, hatred and cruelty right in the family. And you go back and you look earlier in Genesis and you find Cain killing Abel, brothers. We have great hatred between Ishmael and Isaac, and that hatred still manifests itself today. And great hatred between Esau and Jacob, and that hatred is still here. And these brothers don't even know where they've all come from, but the hatred is there. And it's a sad thing between those family members. So where does the problem lie when there's such a great hatred? Let's go to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. Why was there such a great hatred of Joseph by his brothers? Matthew 15, verse 17. Matthew 15, verse 17. It says, do you not understand that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and is eliminated? So something that you eat may be dirty. It may have some dirt on it, but it's no big deal because your body can most likely process it. But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. Those are the things which defile. And these are the things that were impacting Joseph's brothers. They hated him. And it was coming right out of their hearts. When they saw him coming, they did not hesitate in saying, here he comes, let's kill him. And you look at, we won't turn there, but you can look at it later, 1 John chapter 3, verse 15. There it says, whoever hates his brother is a murderer. Even to hate your brother is a murderer. So to hate someone else, basically you are a murderer, because it begins in the heart. And that feeling or that attitude that you have towards somebody where you hate them, that is ungodly. You are a murderer. In Genesis 37, we see the poisonous fruit of the brothers' hatred begin to bud. And we can see that if a sin is not stopped in the heart, as Jesus said, it will produce fruit, because a person is defiled from within. The heart is where the problem begins. And even if it never produces an actual murder or an actual adultery, it will still work to destroy the person in whom the evil thoughts dwell. So if you hate somebody, you may never kill them. You may never take action against them, but you hate them. And that hatred will tear you up. And why is that? Because that hatred, that anger that you have with that person eventually manifests itself as resentment and bitterness. And every time you see that person, that hatred wells up. God's word tells us that many are defiled because of bitterness. And what he means is lost. I mean, they lose their salvation through bitterness. It's one of the outcomes that Paul talks about in the book of Hebrews. It may never break out into what we consider to be an actual act of aggression against a person. But if it's in your heart, it's something that cannot be in God's kingdom. It has to be dealt with and eliminated. Let's look at what Paul says in Hebrews chapter 12. You see, the brothers hated Joseph, and they never dealt with it. They never let it go. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 13. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 13. He's speaking to them here, and he says in verse 12, "Therefore strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather healed." So resentment and bitterness is in a straight path. He says, let it be healed. Let it be healed. And then in verse 14 it says, pursue peace with all people. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Pursue peace with all people. Looking carefully, lest anyone should fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. So, is there peace where there should be, where there is bitterness and resentment? You can't have peace there. You're in a turmoil, you're upset. And he says, look carefully, look inside yourself and see what's there, lest anyone fall. And when he speaks of falling, he's speaking of losing out on salvation. Be careful, because bitterness and resentment can impact others. And you know, the problem is in the heart. And even if a person does not allow it to break out, you know, where you actually punch somebody or you seek to do somebody in, you know, the problem must be dealt with in the heart. As it says, whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. And it's a very serious thing. But we see this outbreak of hatred against Joseph. And really, why did they hate him? If you really went back and looked at what had taken place in the family, why did they hate him? I think if they went back and examined it, they would say, really, this has gotten carried away and we really shouldn't hate our brother. So we can see what happened with Joseph and his brothers. The hatred, the envy that was there finally broke out. And in most cases, sin that is held within needs is the right opportunity to break from within to without. And it did eventually break out in the case of Joseph's brothers and Joseph. No one was watching, and they had the opportunity to take action. You know, Jacob wasn't there. He couldn't control the situation. So they said, hey, we're free to do what we want. You have people that would normally never steal a TV set. People that would never commit a crime as long as people are watching. But what happens once anarchy breaks out? People are busting out windows. Buildings are on fire. There are no policemen around. Don't you see all these people lugging out those TV sets and stereos and whatever else that they can load up? And they would probably never do that if order was in place. But when order breaks down, you see some people doing some things that they would not normally do. And it's an important lesson for all of us, you know, that, you know, what's in our heart? If nobody's looking, what will we do? And obviously, Joseph's brother says, nobody's around, so we'll kill him. And, they plotted the murder, and they also plotted how they would cover it up. Hey, we'll say an animal killed him, and we'll placate our father. And what you see is, you know, they've allowed this envy and this hatred to fester in them, and eventually it manifests itself. So let's go back to Genesis 37 and pick up in verse 23. Genesis chapter 37. And we'll pick up in verse 23. He says, so it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic. So they took off his many-colored coat. the tunic of many colors was on him. And so they took that off. And then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there in killing him, killing our brother? What profit is there in that? Let us sell him to these Ishmaelites and make a few dollars off of this, make a little money off of it." And what's interesting here is in verse 25, it says they sat down to eat. So they had thrown him in the pit and they sat down to eat. Now, why did God include that in the story? He just wanted to let us know they took lunch on that day? Or was he telling us something more? He's telling us about how harsh and cruel the hatred was, how intense their hatred was. They had no regard for Joseph. They threw him in the pit, and they would have killed him and probably still had lunch. But here come the Ishmaelites, and they say, hey, Judah says, hey, let's sell him. They sold him to the Ishmaelites, and it doesn't say, but it's likely they figured, hey, they split up the money, then everybody sat down to enjoy a meal as their brother is being carried off to Egypt with no regard for his safety and the terror that was in his heart as he's going through this terrible trial. I mean, could you imagine your brothers or your family selling you into slavery with no regard for you at all? That'd be a hard thing to take. That'd be a hard thing to take. So the caravan heads off, and he's sold, and we can see the perverseness of human nature on display here. And the brothers weren't sensitive to his situation at all. And as you think about this, one of the things that comes up is one's conscience. And what is the main problem with conscience? Well, the problem is, if we're not careful, it can very quickly adjust its standards. Very quickly, we can compromise our standards. In order for a conscience to behave rightly, it has to have the right standard, God's standard. And we have to believe the standard, believe it, and we have to practice that standard. It's burned into our being. So when we're offered an opportunity that's going to deviate from what we know to be right and true, then we will be repulsed by it. We will recognize this is wrong, and I cannot do this. And but the brothers' minds were first resolved to murder their brother. And they all recognized that murder was a terrible thing. So that when they decided, well, we'll sell him, they all felt like, hey, he is our flesh and blood, we'll just sell him. And they very quickly adjusted their consciences to what they did and felt good about it. They had no qualms about going back to their meal. It's entirely possible that when the deed was done, that, as I said, they went back to their meal, they had some money in their pockets, and all of this showed that they were very quickly willing to compromise their consciences. And, they unfortunately were people who were willing to adjust their standards very quickly. But we know that God has told us that, as he tells us in Matthew chapter 7, he said that we're to enter by the narrow gate. That living as Christians, it is a narrow gate. It doesn't offer us to adjust our conscience or our standards or our values to whatever seems the best at the time. God said, this is the standard. This is what is best. It is a narrow way, and we need to stay on that narrow trail and never get off into that broad way that leads to destruction. And as you look at human nature, one of the manifestations here is that, you know, it has an evil bias. Human nature has an evil bias, and that is, it hates God's law and is not subject to it. So you can very quickly fall into sin. So human nature makes even innocent things into opportunities for sin. And it's something that we need to be conscious of in our lives. Now let's look briefly at another brother in this story. And that's Reuben. Reuben, as we saw, said, hey, let's not kill him. Let's throw him in the pit with plans to come back later. Let's look at Genesis chapter 37 and look at verse 29. So he said, I'll come back and I'll save him and return him to my father. So that's a good thing. It says, then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. So Reuben came back to the pit. Joseph is gone. And it's interesting to look at Reuben's particular example here. And it's an example for all of us because in many ways he's like all of us. We might title him every man because many of us are like him. He stopped them from killing Joseph and was intent on saving him, but that's not what worked out. In the flow of the story, Reuben said that the brothers did not know, as they went on into Egypt, they didn't know who the powerful ruler was there. But his brothers knew, and this is later in the story in Egypt, they knew they were in deep trouble. And they asked, well, why is this happening? Why is this happening? And in their minds, all they had done was come down to Egypt to get enough food to allow them to survive the famine. And now they found themselves in trouble with this ruler of Egypt. They found themselves accused. And Reuben reminded them, this all traces back to killing Joseph and what took place with our brother. He told them not to do that, but they had rejected his counsel. He had counseled them to put him in the pit, and that they had accepted. At least it kept him from being killed. Reuben actually made two efforts to save Joseph. But while he was absent doing his work, the brothers carried out the sale to the caravan. So what he did was well meant and even included no small measure of self-sacrifice on his part. And why was it self-sacrifice? Why would he save Joseph? The reason that it was self-sacrifice was because Reuben was the firstborn. Reuben was the one that would have inherited if he had not committed a particular sin, which we'll discuss here in a moment. And Reuben had already come to realize that the one was actually going to inherit in his father's place was Joseph. So, hey, I have no incentive to go back and save my brother. In fact, I'm in on this because it's going to better my position to take the top position in the family. But Reuben showed some character here by being willing to save Joseph. So the only one in the whole family of sons besides Joseph who appears to have some virtue in him is Reuben. But he was too timid, unfortunately, and did not follow through as fully as he should. He should have gone further. What should he have done? As this whole thing was unfolding, he should have taken command of the situation and grabbed Joseph by the hand and taken him with him wherever he was going to work. I'm going to do my work. You're coming with me, Joseph. And that would have been decisive. And that would have been something that would have been worthy of his leadership as the eldest brother and the recipient of the birthright. And that way he could have prevented this whole thing from happening. But he didn't. He didn't step in and stop it. What did he do? What he did amounted to a compromise. And what God is showing is that to act like Reuben did is a dangerous experiment and never quite cuts it. Reuben should have stood his ground. He should have stood up to his brothers. He should have condemned them for what they were doing. And he should have taken Joseph with him while he did his work. Instead, what did he do? He left them in the hands of the ones who were plotting to murder him. That was probably a bad sign right off the bat. They want to kill him, so I'm going to leave him with the people who hate him and want to kill him. And this fits with another description of Reuben later on in Genesis chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49, Let's look at verses 3 and 4. Genesis chapter 49, verses 3 and 4. It says, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." So those are all good things, good qualities. So Reuben wasn't completely lacking in good qualities. But then you get to verse 4, it says, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it, he went up to my couch." It says that he's unstable as water. And what's that tell us about Reuben? As you think about water, water will, if there's nothing holding it back, will seek its own level. So if you have water dammed up, then it's going to be restrained. It's going to be held back. But once you remove the barrier, that water is going to go to whatever the lowest level is. And that was Reuben. Reuben tended to be a person who, as long as there was restraint, as long as he was around good people that held him back, then he did pretty well. But when that restraint was moved, he was like water and just flowed to the lowest level. And that's exactly what we saw with Reuben and his brothers. And so it also says that as you think about unstable as water, you think about the fact that he was also, as you look at water, it's like the flowing of waves. You know, if there's air blowing across water, you usually get waves, and that's the way he was. He was unstable, like the ocean, always restless, and that's the way he tended to be. Unstable as water indicates a personality dominated by mercurial emotions and being guided almost completely by one's feelings. Feelings are a good gift from God, but you have to control them. And you think about him getting involved with Joseph's concubine, Bilhah. Somehow or other, it worked out where she said, "Hey, big fella, let's have sexual relations." And he said, "All right, the water just flows to the lowest level possible. I can have a little fun." Not thinking of the consequences, not thinking, if I throw this pebble into the pool, there's going to be a ripple effect. And that is the way he was, unstable as water. So the brothers, what did they do? They dipped the tunic of Joseph into the blood and took that tunic back to their father and told their father that Joseph had been killed. And Jacob was despondent as a result of the death of his beloved son. So they came back, they gave him the tunic, they told him what had happened, and they were lying to him. And you know, as they took this all took place, they hated him, but it haunted them for the rest of their lives. It was something they had to live with. And the way those things tend to work, they tend to cause us to, you know, we remember them and things come up and remind us of them. And it kind of haunts you. Let's go to Genesis chapter 42. Genesis chapter 42, just back a few pages. Genesis chapter 42. And this is, let's go down to verse 21. It says there, "Then they said to one another, 'We are truly guilty concerning our brother.'" So long time has passed. We are truly guilty concerning our brothers. 22 years have gone by. And they're still carrying the burden. "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us that we would not, but we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." We are still paying the price for what we did. They were still carrying the burden of what they had done, something they had to deal with throughout their lives. And they had to watch their father in anguish over the loss of his son. And one of the things that we have to realize about life is things can change quickly. Things can change quickly. In about an hour's time, if you really stop and start to calculate it, Joseph went from walking about in the sunlight in his colorful robe with the greatest of freedom and hardly a care in the world, needing nothing. Life was good. Life was good. And within about an hour, he ended up being friendless, put into terror, stripped of his coat, thrown into a darkened pit, sold into slavery, and needing everything. There's a lesson there for all of us, how quickly things can change. Even for the godly, things can change rather quickly. So let's go on to chapter 39 and look at the final lesson we're going to look at here with Joseph. That's important for us to realize, and this is a wonderful lesson for all of us and a lesson for young people in the church. Joseph had, it says in verse 7, let's pick that up, "And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?' So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was inside that she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside." So in this particular section of Scripture, we find out what Joseph was made of. He was a slave in a foreign land, having been stripped of his family and his rights. And it could have been, you know, what he went through could have just caused him to fold up. "I've been thrown in the pit, betrayed by my brothers. Why go on?" And he could have folded. But Joseph recovered and he continued on in the way that he knew that he should live. And it's a good thing that God was involved with Joseph, because if Jacob had been involved in his life, Jacob would have never allowed him to go through such a trauma. Never would he have allowed him to go through this. He would have shielded him, protected him, spoiled him. But God was working things here, not Jacob. And Jacob, because he loved Joseph, would have spoiled him, as I said. But God was not allowing that to happen. He said, "I have a great purpose for Joseph, and I'm going to allow him to go through this." And through this process, Joseph became a great man. So Joseph, with the help of God, had to work out his own salvation. God was there with him, but Joseph had to walk with God through this trial. The true dignity of Joseph is not merely that he faced hardship, accepted it, and made the most of it. A lot of people have done that. But rather, he allowed himself to truly be humbled and to walk humbly before God, to change him to where abilities that were with him could be used by God in developing a Christ-like character, in which God was well pleased, a major difference of other people who go through great difficulties. The story of Joseph's purchase is by Potiphar. We all know that. But it says that Potiphar was the captain of the guard. What does that mean? Was he just a guard, the chief guard? Some commentators have said that what the words in Hebrew actually mean is that Potiphar was the chief of executioners. So how would you like to work in the chief executioner's house? I mean, things could have gone south very quickly. So he wasn't in the home of a particularly nice person. But because of the way Joseph worked, he worked with wisdom and he worked with zeal, Potiphar liked him. So I'm sure that Joseph, this is the way Joseph was, and we see him acting this way throughout his life. It wasn't just in Potiphar's house, it was in all occasions. That's the way he was. In his father's house, And that's what riled his brothers and contributed to them hating him. He was this way in Potiphar's house. He was this way in the future in prison. And so Joseph was zealous to do what was right and to serve his master well. But in that house, you know, Joseph's doing his part. He's zealous. He's faithful. He's a very effective servant. But evil was right inside the house. And we, you know, as you read through the story, we notice the intensity of the seduction. If Joseph had been like Reuben, what would he have done once Potiphar's wife offered herself to him? He would have said, "All right, chance for a little fun." And that probably would have been unwise to do, especially in the executioner's house. But those kinds of things tend to get back to the man of the house. And Joseph would have been found himself in a very bad, an even worse way. It says a lot about Joseph because Joseph was a handsome young man. He had the normal hormonal drive of a young man. And he was in the presence of a very powerful woman with a powerful husband. There was the privacy of a room and perhaps a romantic setting in which he whispered that she not only wanted him, she needed him. And Joseph could have given in to her flattery. In addition to that, he might have said, "You know what, this lady might be a ticket to greater power. So I'll take the shortcut. Yes, I will be involved with her behind her husband's back, and she may help me get ahead in the game. And, it, you know, really, I'm justified in this. Look at what I've gone through. I've been sold into slavery. Here I am. My brothers have betrayed me, and I'm feeling kind of bad, and I can take comfort in this." But he didn't do that. He didn't do that. And he could have justified it, you know, getting involved with her and say, "Hey, it wasn't my fault." He could have taken Adam's way out and said, "She seduced me. I just gave in." But Joseph was a cut above that. Not only that, but it tells us that she kept this up day after day. She didn't ask him once. She kept asking him over and over and over every opportunity she had. And what was Joseph's defense? What was Joseph's defense? Let's look at verses 10 and 11 of Genesis chapter 39. Verse 10 says, "So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was inside that she caught him by his garment. She caught him by his garment, 'Lie with me,' but he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside." So he wasn't going to give in to her, and he recognized the need to flee. And you know what, you know, we really, when you look at the situation here, you know, he could have gone to Potiphar and explained, "Hey, you know, your wife's trying to seduce me." I'm not sure that would have played well with his with Potiphar. You know, and say, "I can't go into the house because your wife's in there, and I don't want to deal with that." So he didn't do that. He let the situation play out. He was going to do what was right, but he was going to let it play out. And she eventually played her cards. And in essence, you know, she's kind of like a snake. She's there in the grass waiting for the perfect opportunity. And she caught him in the room alone. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled outside. He was a long time ahead of what Paul said to the young man. He told Timothy to flee also youthful lust. He was already doing this. He already did that. And so he fled. He sought to flee, and he got in trouble for it, but he did flee and did not actually commit the deed. And his defense is interesting as you go back up to verse 9 as he's talking to this woman and why he does not want to be involved with her. What was his defense? We saw that he fled. But we also know that he saw from the very beginning what was happening for what it was. He said to her, "How can I do this wickedness and sin against God? How can I do this wickedness and sin against God?" He was a young man, He saw that what was being offered was sin. He saw that what was happening was not love, it was lust, and he understood that sex was good, but it should only be in marriage. He also saw in verses 8 and 9 that this was going to be destructive to his master. His master has entrusted him with his whole household. And he basically trusts him to do what is he's given him to do. And he said, I'm going to be disloyal to my master with all that he has entrusted me with. Despite Joseph's young age, there was a maturity there and a greatness that was beginning to show. Human growth is the growth in relationships. And when a baby is born, they are assertive and demanding. When they want something, they want it now, and they let you know that they want it by crying. They cry white right away when they want something. But, you know, we grow up from being babies, and as we mature, we have to learn to adjust ourselves to others. And just because we want it right now, it may be best to hold back and wait till the proper time to show some character, to delay our gratification. And you might think about, what if we were all acting like babies? I think as you look at the world, there are a lot of people acting like babies today. They want whatever they want right now. And that's part of the problem we see. So we see what maturity is. It's when we stop acting like babies until we are acting like God, until we are like Him. And then we are mature. So Joseph was well on his way to maturity. And we can see the quality of character that he had. As I said a little bit earlier, the things that he was going through here, it was a good thing. It was a good thing that God wrenched him away from his household and allowed him to go through this circumstance. You see, the brothers put him in the pit. The brothers sold him. And Joseph was in that circumstance. And God took that circumstance and worked it to Joseph's good. Helped him to grow and mature and to be ready for God's family. And so we might say that when the time for the big game came, Joseph was ready. How was he prepared? There's no evidence in God's word anywhere that God spoke directly to him, as he had spoken to Abraham. God never appeared to Joseph in the way that he appeared to Abraham. Joseph was a great deal more like you and me in that he was taught, in all probability, by his grandfather Isaac and by his dad Jacob. Now, his brothers no doubt had access to the same teaching, but they didn't respond to it. Joseph listened, Joseph believed, and Joseph trusted it. And it's no wonder that he was his father's favorite. Who do you think God the Father's favorites are? You don't think they're the ones that keep his commandments? Hopefully that's all of us. And you see, Joseph, because of what he learned, was ready when the big challenge came. What about all of us? Do you think there are big challenges coming? Look at the world and think about it for a while. I know my wife was saying, as you look at the world, can you believe it's going to go on for 10 more years? It could. I mean, we thought it was over in 1975. But the world has gone on, and it's going to continue on for however long it goes on. And there can be some formidable challenges that we face. And the question is, have we been taught? Do we believe it? Are we practicing it? And when the challenge comes, will we be like Joseph and meet the test? So Joseph is a clear example that all things work together to them who love God and are called according to His purpose. And all the things that we're going through, they work for our development and our maturing in the faith as well. So we will end here today, and in a future sermon conclude the saga of Joseph.